From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with screenwriter and director Mike White. His films include Nacho Libre, The School of Rock, Orange County, and Chuck and Buck. White's latest film, Year of the Dog, starring Molly Shannon and Peter Sarsgaard, is coming out on DVD. Also, we have reviews of the movie Superbad and the TV show High School Musical 2. And we remember Max Roach, a man who played on the A-Team of Bebop. The great jazz drummer died earlier this week at age 83. We'll listen back to a 1987 interview. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Mike White is an actor and writer whose best-known work is the Jack Black film School of Rock, which he wrote and appeared in as Ned Schneebly, Jack's timid roommate. White's other screenplays include The Good Girl, Nacho Libre, Orange County, and Chuck and Buck, which he also starred in. White's also written episodes of several TV series, including Freaks and Geeks and Dawson's Creek. White made his directorial debut earlier this year with Year of the Dog, a film he also wrote, starring Molly Shannon, Peter Sarsgaard, John C. Reilly, and Laura Dern. It's out on DVD later this month. I spoke to Mike White in April, when Year of the Dog opened in theaters. The film features Molly Shannon as Peggy, a single office worker whose closest relationship is with her pet beagle, Pencil. That is, until he dies unexpectedly. She's crushed by the loss of her companion, so a neighbor she's barely spoken to before, played by John C. Reilly, asks her out to dinner. Here they are at a restaurant.
So you were saying you had a dog who died when you were young?
Tessie, I love that dog. I had her since she was a puppy. We did everything together. She was my right-hand bitch. Sorry, I mean, in the dog way of being a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she died way too young. She was only six.
Oh.
Yeah.
How did she die?
I shot her in Wyoming. You want some more wine?
Wait, what do you mean?
It was an accident. A hunting accident.
Oh.
I still feel terrible.
And what were you hunting?
Hunting moose. Mooses. They got a lot of moose up there. Don't worry about it. You ever been hunting?
No.
It can be a rush. But, you know, accidents do happen. And, a gun is a very powerful weapon. I learned that the hard way. That's why I never keep guns in my house.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Just knives.
Well, Mike White, welcome back to Fresh Air. Well, Molly Shannon is at the center of this story. Is it true that you wrote this script with her in mind?
Yeah. I had the inspiration for the movie was I was doing this TV series for Fox. It was a half-hour sitcom with Molly and Jason Schwartzman called Cracking Up that was like a short-lived disaster. And it was one of those things where, like, just constant fighting with the network, never a moment of peace, all, you know, just one of those really bad professional experiences. And I was just sort of overstressed and underslept, and over the Christmas breaks where sometimes you try to catch up on scripts, I had this stray cat who lived behind my house who sort of unexpectedly died on me one day. It was like on Christmas Day, actually. And I didn't even know I was that attached to the cat, but I was so sort of emotionally kind of unhinged by this cat dying. And I ended up writing the like most depressing half hour of that show. And the network hated more than the other stuff I had already been doing, and ended up getting even more behind. And it was just like basically the show shut down. And I really think if that cat hadn't died, it wouldn't have had such a sort of profoundly depressing end. And when the dust settled on it, I looked back and I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting life experience. And you know, the thing was, I just had such a great time with Molly. I just felt like it's like, you know, when you make a movie or you have a TV series, you feel like you're throwing a party and you invite all these people to your party and you tell them it's going to be fun. And then it turns out not to be fun and it just goes on forever. And it was just one of those things where I was like, I'd like to throw a party for Molly where it actually was fun and we had a good time and it turned out good.
Right. So the story kind of revolves around people, adults who are in some ways obsessed with their pets. Was there something about that idea that connected to Molly Shannon?
Well, not so much the pets, but I do think that like there's just sort of an innocence about Peggy and a sweetness. And the thing about Molly is she's kind of preternaturally like positive. There's just something like she just has like she's just such a kind, like she's so giving as just in communication and in life. And I just thought, you know, people think of her as like the girl who's like sniffing her armpits and falling over bleacher chairs from Saturday Night Live. And right. I just, you know, it's like there's just such a sweet sweet warmth to Molly, and I just wanted to create a character that she got to show some of those colors to.
You know, you've covered a lot of different subject areas when I look at the body of work that you've written. But it seems that a lot of your central characters are sort of on the fringe of worlds they inhabit, sort of restless, dissatisfied people. Were you like that growing up?
Well, I definitely relate to somebody who feels like their interests or their persona or whatever is somehow outside of the mainstream, and that the sort of conventional world is something that they feel slightly alienated from. And so I tend to like to write characters that kind of, you know, whether by their passion or their goals or who they are, sort of are subverting the status quo or the world they're in.
Right. Now, you went to Wesleyan University and were lucky enough to get writing work in Hollywood pretty quickly, did a lot of television work. And then in 2000, you wrote and started in Chuck and Buck, which is this film where you play Buck, this guy in his 20s who's sort of has the social development of a 12-year-old and who's trying to reconnect with his childhood friend Chuck. And here is a scene where Buck, who's the kind of socially studded guy, visits Chuck in his office. I think we have a clip.
After you left, I didn't really get into school at all, you know. I didn't like the other kids so much. All the homework and sports just wasn't fun. It's weird you have this office. What are you doing here?
Sign bands and produce and negotiate contracts. It's not all that interesting.
That's funny. That's really funny. Because do you remember we used to play games like we were businessmen? Remember we bought all those office supplies? And now you're like really doing it. Is it real now or is it still like a game?
It's pretty real.
And that's my guest, Mike White, along with Chris Weitz in the film Chuck and Buck, which Mike White wrote and starred in. You know, in this film, Chuck, the kind of more socially stunted of the two, is sexually attracted to his old friend, but kind of sees sex as an adolescent does, and he sort of becomes a stalker. What's interesting about this film, I know that you didn't direct it and didn't do the casting, but you ended up playing the lead, and you inhabit this role so completely convincingly that I wonder if it sort of followed you and people assume it's in some way autobiographical.
Well, I did get a lot of that when the movie first came out, and you know, certainly the first, it was a weird thing to, you know, have your first movie and be in it and be sort of recognized to be that character and have all of those sort of, I don't know, assumptions or questions that come with that. But, you know, in a way it was a really creatively, liberating, because when you have, once you kind of like jump out of the airplane and have that kind of real sense of just like, gosh, you know, all these people either think I'm crazy or I'm this character. It just sort of like, you realize you can't control that. And you know, you'll never win the popularity contest in a sense. So you can kind of just give up that goal and just kind of pursue the stuff that makes it, you know, that's meaningful to you.
Did it open doors for you, this film?
Yeah, weirdly. I mean, it was like one of those movies that, like, when I wrote it, you know, and said I was going to make it, I mean, people would read the script and say, not only do I not want to, like, you know, give you the money to make this, but I think you really shouldn't make this. Don't make this movie kind of thing. So it was interesting that when you actually, you know, once it was made and we put it out there, that, you know, it was a movie that, you know, kind of seems to have stuck around. And certainly it did open doors for me in terms of, you know, people, you know, screenwriters suffer from anonymity, I think, in a sense. And whether, even if, like, you know, people think maybe I'm a crazy stalker, at least they recognize me and can identify me with the work that I do. And that has certainly been helpful in some sense in this
right.
business.
Actor, writer, and director Mike White. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor, writer, and director Mike White. His film Year of the Dog is out on DVD later this month. A lot of people know your film School of Rock, which you also wrote, and which stars Jack Black as this out-of-work rock musician who, desperate for money, gets a gig as a substitute teacher in a private school, and then kind of uses the kids to create a rock band, which he can star in. Where did that idea come from?
Well, I was living next door to Jack for a few years and became friendly with him. And sometimes he would give me scripts that people, you know, that had been offered to him. And, you know, I wasn't really in the big sort of comedy rewrite world or whatever, but I kept reading these scripts and I was like, you know, I could write something for him that would be more appealing potentially than these scripts that he's giving to me. And there's something so winning about Jack. And up to that point, it felt like he was really just getting the parts of like the like drunk frat guy or, you know, who's falling through windows or whatever. I just thought it would be fun to kind of make a movie with him with kids and try to like open up his audience base and try to do something that's sweeter.
Well, it really worked. Let's hear a clip from School of Rock. This is Jack Black, where has his students who he's making into, who he's crafting, molding into a rock band, and here's where he's explaining to them the nature of rock and roll.
You guys have been doing real good in here. And if I was going to give you a grade, I would give you an A. But that's the problem. Rock ain't about doing things perfect. Who can tell me what it's really about? Frankie.
Scoring chicks?
No. See? No. Eleni?
Getting wasted.
No. Come on. No. Leonard.
Sticking it to the man?
Yes. But you can't just say it, man. You gotta feel it in your blood and guts. If you wanna rock, you gotta break the rules. You gotta get mad at the man. And right now, I'm the man. That's right, I'm the man. And who's got the guts to tell me off? Huh? Who's gonna tell me off?
Shut the hell up, Schneebly.
That's it, Freddy. That's it. Who can top him?
Get out of here, stupid ass.
Yes, Alicia.
You're a joke. You're the worst teacher I've ever had.
Summer, that is great. I like the delivery because I felt your anger.
Thank you.
You're a fat loser and you have body odor.
All right.
And that is Jack Black from School of Rock, written by my guest, Mike White. It's just so much fun to watch Jack Black in this role. It's sort of hard to imagine anybody else having done it. Were there certain mannerisms or certain styles he had that you wanted to get into this character?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I, again, it was just like with Molly, it was like I really wrote something specifically for him. And, you know, I knew he was going to bring a lot of his own stuff to it. But I tried to write something that was as much in his voice and, you know, with his mannerisms as I had observed in my time living next door to him. He just, you know, the thing about Jack, and I find that's true about Molly and certain people that are, you know, at the highest level of, you know, comedy, that they just are funny. Like, I don't think Jack has ever left a message on my machine that wasn't humorous. And I don't think it's not necessarily that he's always on or trying really hard. There's just something sort of funny about the way he, you know, words come out of his mouth. And so that makes it easier to write comedy when you have somebody who can just kind of sell it.
Now you also had you had kids in this, which were a critical element of it working. How did you picture the kids in School of Rock? I mean, it's not quite Fame, not quite Bad News Bears.
Well, I felt like it's like you needed, with Jack, you need somebody who's like crashing the sort of the party. So the, in a sense that I felt like it was important to like make the kids in a more sort of, you know, uptight, you know, very academic and competitive school, because it felt like that then he would really be the fish out of water in that world. So, and I had gone to a school growing up that was pretty rigorous and similar to the school in School of Rock. But Rick Linklater really deserves the credit for finding these kids, especially the ones that were in the band. It was really important to him to find kids that really played that music and could perform, so it didn't feel like some cheesy, you know, like some cheesy TV show where everybody is lip syncing in the big finale.
Right. You know, a colleague of mine at the Philadelphia Daily News said that that movie was like a life-altering experience for his kids who were playing music and really got into classic rock after that. I mean, was there any kind of mission here? I'm wondering if, did you have any particular relationship to rock and roll that informed this idea?
I mean, for me, it's more the creative impulse. I mean, I went to a school that was very sort of like focused on the mathematics and the sciences and, you know, very preparatory. And I was this sort of creative person and felt like that part of my education wasn't as much focused on and had sort of wished it had been. And so whether it was rock music or, you know, writing or just anything that was more creative, it was what I was kind of trying to do was talk about, you know. And, you know, the thing is, when I was a kid and watched movies, I would come home and sort of reenact the movie, especially if something that really caught my inspiration. And so there was a part of me that was writing to that kid in me, which was sort of saying, you know, go out and do it, you know, like just a sort of call to you know, follow your creative impulses.
Now, I know you also grew up in a conservative Christian home. I mean, did that make it harder to explore creative stuff?
I mean, not so much. I mean, my dad was a minister, and he came from a really conservative Christian background, but he was a filmmaker and a writer. So it wasn't so much that, you know, my parents were squashing that creative impulse at all. But, yeah, so not no. So much. It does actually affect the fact that, like, I don't have a very long sort of rock musical education, because, you know, we had sort of more, you know, gospel and Christian music in our house. And so I think people think, well, since I've written School of Rock, that I'm some sort of rock aficionado, and there's actually huge gaps in my rock education.
After School of Rock, you did another film with Jack Black that was a vehicle for his energy, called Nacho Libre, where he plays Ignacio, who is a cook in a monastery that's raising orphans in Mexico, and then decides to adopt a secret life as a wrestler in the Lucha Libre contest so he can afford fresh ingredients for his orphans' meals. Where did this idea come from?
Well, I was working on this script with Jared and Jerusha Hess. Jared directed Napoleon Dynamite, and they wrote it, that movie together. And the three of us got together, and, you know, Jared was really excited about writing a movie about Mexican luchadors for Jack. So we, you know, I don't know, we spent a few weeks in Salt Lake City and kind of came up with this story. It was one of the best sort of, or the most fun collaborative experiences I've had.
Let's hear a clip. Here, Jack Black as Ignacio has come upon a bunch of the orphans that he cares for wrestling. And Sister Encarnacion tells them they can't do this and wants Ignacio to explain to the kids why wrestling is bad.
Orphans, listen to me. Listen to Ignacio. I know it is fun to wrestle. A nice pile drive to the face, mm-hmm. or a punch to the face. But you cannot do it, because it is in the Bible not to wrestle your neighbor.
So you've never wrestled?
Me? No, come on, don't be crazy. Listen, I know the wrestlers get all the fancy ladies, and the clothes, and the free creams and lotions. But my life is good. Really good. I get to wake up every morning at 5 a.m. and make some soup. It's the best. I love it. I get to lay in a bed by myself all of my life. It's fantastic.
And that is Jack Black as Ignacio in the film Nacho Libre, written by our guest Mike White. You know, this seems like an idea that really could miss. And you have, like, Jack Black here. He's, you know, has this accent. And was there ever any concern that you'd be seen as sort of showing the cultural sensitivity of the Frito Bandito?
Well, I mean, because the idea came to me through Jared, I was concerned, and certainly Jack was concerned about all of that. But, you know, Jared is such a real deep fan of this world. And, you know, he's a Mormon and spent years in South America on his mission and speaks fluent Spanish and is just a real sort of like, you know, diehard fan of the luchador culture and South American cultures. And it just felt like it was coming from such a pure place, you know, even though his stuff is sort of twisted and like he does have a sort of absurd take on humanity. It didn't feel like it was sort of playing on stereotypes. It felt like there was just something more interesting about where the humor was coming from.
Well, Mike White, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Oh, cool. Thanks for having me.
Director Mike White recorded in April. His film Year of the Dog is out on DVD later this month. This Sunday marks the 30th anniversary of the death of Groucho Marx. We'll end this half with his recording of Lydia the Tattooed Lady from the 1939 film At the Circus, with music and lyrics by Harold Arlen and Yip Harburg. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Lydia, oh Lydia, say, have you met Lydia? Lydia the Tattooed Lady. She has eyes that folks adore so, and a torso even more so. Lydia, oh Lydia, that encyclopedia. Oh Lydia, the queen of tattoo. On her back is the Battle of Waterloo. Beside it, the wreck of the Hesperus too. And proudly above waves the red, white, and blue. You can learn a lot from Lydia. When a robe is unfurled, she will show you the world if you step up and tell her where. For a dime, you can see Kankakee.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Somerset Maugham's novel Of Human Bondage, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children, on the web at covertheuninsured.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember the life and rhythms of Max Roach. The legendary jazz drummer died this week at age 83. He got his big break back in the 1940s when Duke Ellington's drummer called out sick. Also, David Edelstein reviews the film Superbad, and TV critic David Bianculli tells us about High School Musical 2. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. The new teen comedy Superbad is co-produced by Judd Apatow, who made Knocked Up and The 40-Year-Old Virgin. The film features alumni from two cult TV series. Co-writer Seth Rogen worked with Apatow on Freaks and Geeks, and Superbad director Greg Mottola and co-star Michael Cera were part of Arrested Development. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Superbad might be the most provocative teen sex comedy ever made. I hedge because it's just opening, and the only ones provoked so far are nerdy male film critics. We love it. Its heroes are graduating high school buddies swimming in hormones and uncertainty. Seth, played by Jonah Hill, is blobby and loud. Evan, played by Michael Cera, is skinny and hysterical. Seth is a virgin and likely to remain so for some time, but talks of nothing but sex, a non-stop stream of naughty words that would make David Mamet sit up and salute. Evan is cuter and sweeter. Embarrassed by his friend's sexism, he talks of respecting women, not that he's been with any. Both look to an upcoming party for resolution. Their task is to procure alcohol, which Seth is sure will get them into bed. In the course of their odyssey, they plunge into a night world of sex, drugs, and aggression. The co-producer is Judd Apatow, the co-writer Seth Rogen, both of Knocked Up. Some conservative commentators pretzeled themselves up to praise their last collaboration, which had four-letter words and drugs and premarital sex, but Hallelujah came down on the side of family values. The same is true of Superbad, but the pretzels will have to be even twistier. Apatow and company have a pipeline to the adolescent id, and a little too much fun if you're a moralist, frolicking in its hot springs of obscenity. If teens emerge with the message that booze and sex and drugs can't buy them love, they might also feel the compulsion to talk dirty, drink, have sex, and learn the lesson for themselves. Besides Seth and Evan, there's a third major character in Superbad. His name is Fogel. He's played by newcomer Christopher Mintz-Plasse, and he is a dork. Elected to buy booze, he's created a fake ID with a wildly optimistic pseudonym.
Hawaii. Mm-hmm. All right, that's good. It's hard to trace, I guess. Wait, you changed your name to McLovin? McLovin? What kind of a stupid name is that, Fogel? What, are you trying to be an Irish R&B singer?
Have you actually ever met anyone named McLovin?
It doesn't even have a first name. It just says McLovin.
What? One name? One name? Who are you, Seal?
Fogel, this ID says you're 25 years old. Why wouldn't you just put 21, man?
How many 21-year-olds do you think there are in this town?
It's gonna work. It's passable, okay? This isn't terrible. I mean, it's up to you, Fogel. This guy's either gonna think here's another kid with a fake ID, or here's McLovin, the 25-year-old Hawaiian organ donor. Okay, so what's it gonna be?
I am McLovin.
I believe McLovin will enter the lexicon. There will be McLovin fests. McLovin, McLovin's. Superbad is like American Graffiti, with a crucial difference. The adults are more childlike than the kids. In George Lucas's Pan to Lost Innocence, the teens sabotaged a police cruiser. In Superbad, two drunken cops, played by Rogen and Bill Hader, shoot up their own car to impress McLovin, whom they've adopted after picking him up in a liquor store. In a book, writer Christopher Knoxon dubbed adults who don't want to grow up rejuveniles, and Apatow is their impresario. But his celebration is double-edged. In search of alcohol, Seth and Evan stumble into a grown-up inferno where very weird things go down. At close to 2 hours, Superbad feels 15 minutes too long, although the director, Greg Mottola, and the screenwriters, Rogen and Evan Goldberg, hey, Seth and Evan, like the characters, they want to take you past the high to the inevitable plummet. No American Pie climactic couplings here. Instead, puke and loathing. The filmmakers linger on the homoerotic undercurrents of adolescent male friendship in a way that other teen sex comedies avoid like the gay plague. That's what makes Superbad so vital, and of its time. In the 70s and 80s, even explicit teen sex comedies like Fast Times at Ridgemont High unfolded in a culture with a fair amount of shame. Now, with American Pie as a touchstone, with MySpace turning even shy people into exhibitionists, filmmakers can begin where their predecessors ended. Superbad takes place in a world in which everyone acts out. It suggests we don't have to worry about repression, but about having nothing left to repress.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Today, the Disney Channel officially premieres High School Musical 2, the sequel to the 2006 telemovie. TV critic David Bianculli says that while High School Musical success was a surprise even to Disney, its hit status isn't that hard to figure out.
What is High School Musical, and just how big a hit is it? Basically, it's a little made-for-TV movie that came out in January 2006, with less fanfare than a couple other Disney Channel projects that winter. It starred a cast of complete unknowns and told two simple love stories at the same time. One was about a high school basketball star who developed an instant crush on a shy new girl in class after singing a karaoke duet with her. The other was how they came to embrace their love, not only for each other, but for musical theater, trying out for the school show, even though, especially to his friends on the basketball team, that just wasn't cool. Until, by the end, it was. The stars of High School Musical and its sequel include Zac Efron, who's already landed a major role in the new movie musical version of Hairspray. He plays Troy, the basketball star. Vanessa Hudgens plays his singing girlfriend Gabriella. And Ashley Tinsdale portrays the snobby rich girl who tries to win Troy for herself. Her character goes by the wonderful name of Sharpay. For girls and even boys flirting with either side of puberty, this kind of school-age story is almost like a classic myth. Instead of the class divide of Romeo and Juliet or the racial divide of West Side Story, the conflict in High School Musical is between various high school subsets, ones that are just as identifiable today as when you or I were there. The jocks, the nerds, the cheerleaders, the slackers. Troy and Gabriella could just as easily be Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland getting together to put on a show. Or Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello playing beach blanket bingo and other wholesome games. The first time out, Disney had no idea what it had on his hands. Like Grease or Dirty Dancing, two other films with similar themes, the original High School Musical ended up being embraced and claimed by an entire new generation. It's worth noting, by the way, that the director and choreographer of High School Musical is Kenny Ortega, who did the choreography for Dirty Dancing. The last time Disney was caught this much by surprise when a TV program became an instant phenomenon was more than 50 years ago, when Fess Parker's Davy Crockett made coonskin caps a fashion statement. Originally, there were only three Davy Crockett adventures, and in the third one, he died at the Alamo. But the show was so popular, Walt Disney kept the franchise alive by presenting television's first official prequels. This time, with High School Musical 2, the Disney organization isn't messing around. The new telemovie starts where the old one was set, at East High School, with the students at the same desks in front of the same teacher. But this time, they're literally counting down the moments until school ends, not only for the class and for the day, but for the summer.
There was that unforgettable summer of dinner theater where I was the only actress to understand all the roles in the entire season's repertoire.
Now my girls, what it's all about.
Ready for some sunshine, for my heart to take shape.
Oh, yeah.
I'm here to stay, not moving, no way. Ready for a summer romance.
Hey. Everybody's ready, going crazy, yeah, we're around.
Come on and let me hear you say it now, right now.
What time is it, summer?
Then, in a clever shift of locale, High School Musical 2 moves to a wealthy summer resort owned by Sharpay's parents. She has the manager offer Troy a job so she can be near him all summer. And Troy talks the manager into hiring all of his friends, including Gabriella, so they can be there too. So there's the same romantic triangle. And, of course, the same pressure to mount a big end-of-season variety show. If I sound unusually tolerant of this movie and genre, I have to admit, as a guy who went through high school on the musical theater tech crew, it's hitting me in my soft spot. But as both a student and teacher of TV history, I also love what this High School Musical franchise represents. At a time when the broadcast networks largely and stupidly are ignoring young viewers, cable networks such as Nickelodeon and the Disney Channel are building their own little empires and stars by programming for the next generation. A franchise like High School Musical not only makes tons of money for Disney, it introduces literally millions of kids to the joys and possibilities of musical theater. And the High School Musical wave is far from over with this sequel, by the way. In the next few months, on the Disney Channel, we'll see a documentary by Barbara Koppel showing a couple of the more than 100 amateur stage productions that have been produced since the TV musical came out. After that, there's a big screen movie in the works. And if Disney can bring Beauty and the Beast and The Lion King to Broadway and turn them into durable, well-received hits, I predict it won't be too long before High School Musical gets the same treatment.
David Biancooley is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, we remember legendary drummer Max Roach, who died yesterday. This is Fresh Air. Max Roach, the innovative drummer who was one of the leaders of the jazz revolution of the 1940s, died in New York yesterday. He was 83. In a career that spanned more than half a century, Roach worked with the immortals of jazz, helping formulate the language of bebop with Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, and Dizzy Gillespie, and later teaming up with trumpeter Clifford Brown for what many regarded as the quintessential bop group of the 50s. Don Heckman wrote in the LA Times that as an instrumentalist, Roach brought the drum set to the front of the stage, making each element of the kit into a unique individual instrument. No longer a roaring sound behind the horns, the drums after Roach became a musical source of infinite possibilities. Roach became known for doing the unexpected. He performed unaccompanied. He wrote music for plays by Sam Shepard and dance pieces by Alvin Ailey, and worked with video artists, gospel choirs, and hip-hop performers. He earned a degree in composition and began teaching in the 1970s, and in 1988 was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant. He was also politically active. In the early 60s, Roach recorded the album We Insist, The Freedom Now Suite, some of the first jazz music inspired by the civil rights movement. He was touring and performing as recently as 2000. Terry Gross spoke to Max Roach in 1987.
How did you first meet some of the people who you became very close with and made now classic music together with? I'm thinking of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. Did they find you? Did you find them?
Well, Dizzy Gillespie heard me at a jam session in a place called Monroe's Uptown House. Clark Monroe was the brother-in-law of Billie Holiday's first husband, Jimmy Monroe, and he was like a kind of a patron for young talent. In these after-hour clubs. These after-hour clubs would open up at 4 in the morning and go until 8. So we could work those places and still go to school, Bud Powell and a crowd of us. Well, he heard me. He was at Cab Calloway. He heard me. He says, someday when I get my own band, when I leave Cab Calloway, I would like for you to play for me. That's how I met Dizzy. And Dizzy introduced me to Coleman Hawkins. I got my first record date. And Dizzy was kind of like the catalyst of that whole movement that we call bebop. You know, he brought Charlie Parker, he discovered, in a way, you know, he brought Charlie Parker to New York and Bud Powell and all these wonderful people. He kind of had a group around him, you know, and I was just fortunate enough to be part of that, but that's how I really got started.
You were one of the first drummers to play bebop, and you were one of the first people to figure out how to drum in the kind of fiery sessions that were being played. What were some of the challenges that presented to you?
Well, when they played fast, they played very fast. It was a period where instrumental virtuosity was in our area, in the jazz area, was now prevailed. Because during the war, you know, we had an extra, the Second World War, we had an extra 20% cavalry taxes, very complex. Simply, to put it very simply, it was if an entrepreneur hired, he had to pay for, say, he had to pay a city tax, like in New York, he had to pay a state tax and a federal tax. And upon that, he had, on top of that, he had to pay a 20% government tax called entertainment tax if he had a singer, if he had public dancing or dancing on a stage or a comedian. This really heralded the demise of big bands during that time. This just tax was just awful, you know. So the people who really got the jobs were the virtuoso instrumentalists. So everybody went home and practiced, and then that was the beginning of bebop, like the people who, so Charlie Parker and Dizzy and Shearing, the virtuoso players were the ones who people would come and sit down. Everybody began to sit and listen to the music rather than get up and dance to it. That was the beginning of it.
What rhythms had you been playing before? And what rhythms did you shift into playing when you started playing bop? Because you really had to, invent new rhythms.
I had help, too. I had a lot of help. I had my my mentors were people like Big Sidney Catlett and Chick Webb and Joe Jones with the Count Basie Band, for folks who don't know. These were people who played with Louis Armstrong, and Sidney Catlett did, and later went with Benny Goodman. Sidney Catlett took Gene Krupa's place when Krupa started his own band. But all these folks, they were doing pretty much the same thing, but only in large band contexts. When you played in a small band, you had to do more. More was required of you because there were less people. It was like playing in a string quartet vis-a-vis a symphony orchestra. It's much more interesting for the individual player. Of course, an orchestra is interesting for the composer and the conductor and the soloist. But when you play in a smaller context, everybody has to do more to fill up the sound. So this was required of us, actually. I don't think we were aware of it, excepting that that first small band I worked in, the first one was Dizzy's. I worked in small bands, of course, all around the city at that time, but Dizzy was the one that his band with Charlie Parker and Oscar Pettiford and Bud Powell or Charles Mingus, that was all the virtuoso people got together. But we knew that everybody had to be kind of busy. So consequently, you heard more drums, you heard more piano, you heard more this and that and the other to fill it out. That's to put it very simply, of course.
Right. Well, to put it less simply, we'll hear some of what you were playing then. This is from the mid-1940s, and this is my guest, Max Roach, as recorded with Miles Davis and Charlie Parker, and we're going to hear Coco. Coco was recorded in 1945 with my guest Max Roach on drums and Miles Davis on trumpet, Charlie Parker on alto saxophone. Does it bring back memories for you? Do you listen back to that
sure
much?
It sure does. It'd be Charlie Parker at that time, as well as Dizzy. The music was very, very fresh, and I guess you would equate it with what we hear today from people like Anthony Braxton. At least they treated us that way. We were the new breed on the scene, and And they would say things, well, the critics would say, Dizzy sounds like he's playing with a mouthful of marbles. And Charlie Parker was playing scales from a saxophone book, just only scales. And Max Roach dropped bombs. I don't know, but it was interesting. Bud Powell had no left hand. And it was you know, we were criticized. But some of it was valid, I thought. You know, we had a long way to go, you know.
Max Roach speaking with Terry Gross in 1987. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's 1987 interview with legendary drummer Max Roach, who died yesterday.
Was this the life you had planned on when you wanted to become a jazz musician? Because you started playing at a time when the big bands were still around, and being a jazz musician meant going on tour with Earl Hines or Cab Calloway, Duke Ellington, one of the big bands. But you actually came of age. You know, you grew right after that. Mm-hmm. You came of age in a time when it was small groups, as you were saying before, and the life just became very different.
It did. Well, I hadn't planned on really becoming taking jazz music that seriously at the time. But the war and all the things that did happen. And then while I was in my senior year at Boys High, I'd met this gentleman, Clark Munro, and worked in his after-hour club. Well, Sonny Greer, Duke's great drummer, was ill, and most of the great drummers were in the Army, like Joe Jones, Sidney Cabot, etc. I could read music. So, Clark, because in those after-hour spots, you played, as I said before, for Shake Dancer, you played Cachaturian, you did all kinds of things. And when Sonny Greer got sick, Duke Ellington called Mr. Munro up for, did he know a drummer who could play a show? Duke was at the New York Paramount. He said, I got a kid who works at my club that plays a show. And I went down to the New York Paramount, make a long story short, got on the stage, and looked at Mr. Greer's music stand. There was no music stand and no music. And I couldn't play by ear at that time. You know, I was about 17. So everything was by ear. So Mr. Ellington, before the curtain came up, he looked at me and saw the fright of fear in my face and said, keep one eye on me and one eye on the act on the stage. And I made it through, but then I made up my mind I wanted to be in this area of the music because Duke had all the theater and the drama and the pageantry was just surrounded him when he presented a show, and that's when I really decided that was what I wanted to do.
In the 1960s, in the early 1960s, you started to play music inspired by the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. Had you become an activist then?
Well, I guess we always have been. You know, it was just something that you, people ask me that quite often, but I go back to Bessie Smith with Black Mountain Blues and then to Duke Ellington with his black, brown, and beige. And it's always been there. Had Leadbelly always spoke about the issues and the times that existed. And many of the old black folk singers from the South, the street musicians, dealt with it. And so to me, it was just I had an opportunity to say something, and I used them. In fact, the suite was commissioned by the youth movement of the NAACP, and we premiered it here in Philadelphia at one of their conventions. That's what it was. In 1960, it was. We were originally commissioned to do something for the centennial of the Emancipation Proclamation, and so that's how it came about.
Was it at all risky for you to do politically inspired music? Were you going to? Did you run into any trouble in getting recording dates afterwards or club dates because of your involvement in the civil rights movement, and you know, I don't think so.
I'll tell you what did happen that was very positive. It sneaked into South Africa, or rather, it went into South Africa. It didn't sneak in. It was taken into South Africa as a jazz musician's album until people read the liner notes put out by Nat Hentoff, and the pieces were a comment. Of course, Oscar Brown Jr., of course, was the lyricist on the work. It was a comment on the things that happened in Sharpeville, the massacre, and things like that. So when the authorities in South Africa realized that this was not just simply a jazz album, they banned it and hit the UPI and AP, and it became a celebrity record. And it sold more records, I guess, than anything I had ever made at that time.
Max Roach speaking with Terry Gross in 1987. He died yesterday at the age of 83. We'll close with a track from Roach's We Insist, The Freedom Suite, featuring Max Roach and singer Abby Lincoln. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. From Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Sit Down Comedy. We talk with comedian David Steinberg. Back in the 60s and 70s, he appeared on The Tonight Show over 100 times. Steinberg's new memoir is called The Book of David. Join us for the next Fresh Air.